The entire two-story structure that was the monastery was fashioned of rough stone, none larger than could have been lifted into place by a single man. The rear of the building was built right into the mountainside. The structure seemed to have been built under an existing overhang in the rock, so there was minimal roofing exposed to the elements. What did show was made of terracotta tiles that lay on a steep incline, obviously to shed any buildup of snow. A short and hairless monk, wearing a saffron-colored robe, led us across an outer courtyard paved with flagstone through an austere doorway into the monastery. The floor inside was stone, and though immaculately clean, it was no more finished than the flagstone of the courtyard. There were only a few windows, more like arrow slits, cut high in the wall, and little light penetrated the interior once the front door was closed. The air was thick with incense and filled with a buzzing chorus of male voices producing a rhythmic chant that seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere at once and made it seem as if my ribs and kneecaps were vibrating from the inside. Whatever language they were chanting in, I didn't understand, but the message was clear. These men were invoking something that transcended this world. The monk led us up a narrow stairway into a long, narrow corridor lined with open doorways no higher than my waist. As we passed, I could see that these must be the monk's cells, and each was just large enough to accommodate a small man lying down. There was a woven mat on the floor and a woolen blanket rolled up at the top of each cell, but there was no evidence of personal possessions nor storage for any. There were no doors to close for privacy. In short, it was very much like what I had grown up with, which didn't make me feel any better about it. Nearly 5 years of the relative opulence at Balthazar's fortress had spoiled me. I yearned for a soft bed and a half dozen Chinese concubines to hand-feed me and rub my body with fragrant oils. Well, I said I was spoiled. At last, the monk led us into a large open chamber with a high stone ceiling, and I realized that we were no longer in a man-made structure, but a large cave. At the far end of the cave was a stone statue of a man seated cross-legged, his eyes closed, his hands before him, with the first fingers and thumbs forming closed circles. Lit by the orange light of candles, a haze of incense smoke hanging about his shaved head, he appeared to be praying. The monk, our guide, disappeared into the darkness at the sides of the cave, and Joshua and I approached the statue cautiously, stepping carefully across the rough floor of the cave. We had long since lost our surprise and outrage at graven images. The world at large and the art we had seen in our travels served to dampen even that grave commandment. "Bacon," Joshua said when I asked him about it. This great room was the source of the chanting we had been hearing since entering the monastery, and after seeing the monks' cells, we determined that there must be at least 20 monks adding their voices to the droning, although the way the cave echoed, it might have been 1 or 1,000. As we approached the statue, trying to ascertain what sort of stone it was made from, it opened its eyes. "Is that you, Joshua?" it said in perfect Aramaic. "Yes," said Joshua. "And who is this?" "This is my friend, Biff." "Now he will be called 21, when he needs to be called, and you shall be 22. While you are here, you have no name." The statue wasn't a statue, of course. It was Gaspar. The orange light of the candles and his complete lack of motion or expression had only made him appear to be made of stone. I suppose we were also thrown off because we were expecting a Chinese. This man looked as if he were from India. His skin was even darker than ours, and he wore the red dot on his head that we had seen on Indian traders in Kabul and Antioch. It was difficult to tell his age, as he had no hair or beard, and there wasn't a line in his face. "He's the Messiah," I said, "the Son of God. You came to see him at his birth." Still no expression from Gaspar. He said, "The Messiah must die if you are to learn. Kill him tomorrow." "Excuse me?" I said. "Tomorrow you will learn. Feed them," said Gaspar. Another monk, who looked almost identical to the first monk, came out of the dark and took Joshua by the shoulder. He led us out of the chapel chamber and back to the cells where he showed Joshua and me our accommodations. He took our satchels away from us and left. He returned in a few minutes with a bowl of rice and a cup of weak tea for each of us. Then he went away, having said nothing since letting us in. "Chatty little guy," I said. Joshua scooped some rice into his mouth and grimaced. It was cold and unsalted. "Should I be worried about what he said about the Messiah dying tomorrow, do you think? You know how you've never been completely sure whether you were the Messiah or not?" "Yeah. Tomorrow, if they don't kill you first thing in the morning, tell them that." The next morning, Number 7 Monk awakened Joshua and me by whacking us in the feet with a bamboo staff. To his credit, Number 7 was smiling when I finally got the sleep cleared from my eyes, but that was a really small consolation. Number 7 was short and thin, with high cheekbones and widely set eyes. He wore a long orange robe woven from rough cotton and no shoes. He was clean-shaven, and his head was also shaved, except for a small tail that grew out at the crown and was tied with a string. He looked as if he could be anywhere from 17 to 35 years old. It was impossible to tell. Should you wonder about the appearance of monks 2 through 6 and 8 through 20, just imagine Number 7 monk 19 times. Or at least that's how they appeared to me for the first few months. Later, I'm sure, except that we were taller and round-eyed, Joshua and I, or monks 21 and 22, would have fit the same description. When one is trying to shed the bonds of ego, a unique appearance is a liability. That's why they call it a uniform. But alas, I'm getting ahead of myself. Number 7 led us to a window that was obviously used as a latrine, waited while we used it, then took us to a small room where Gaspar sat. His legs crossed in a seemingly impossible position, with a small table before him. The monk bowed and left the room, and Gaspar asked us to sit down, again in our native Aramaic. We sat across from him on the floor. No, that's not right. We didn't actually sit. We lay on the floor on our sides, propped up on one elbow, the way we would have been at the low tables at home. We sat after Gaspar produced a bamboo staff from under the table and, with a motion as fast as a striking cobra's, whacked us both on the side of the head with it. "I said sit," he said. Then we sat. "Jeez," I said, rubbing the knot that was swelling over my ear. "Listen," Gaspar said, holding the stick up to clarify exactly what he meant. We listened as if they were going to discontinue sound any second, and we needed to stock up. I think I even stopped breathing for a while. "Good," said Gaspar, laying the stick down and pouring tea into three simple bowls on the table. We looked at the tea sitting there, steaming. Just looked at it. Gaspar laughed like a little boy, all the graveness and authority from a second ago gone from his face. He could have been a benevolent older uncle. In fact, except for the obviously Indian features, he reminded me a lot of Joseph, Joshua's stepfather. "No Messiah," Gaspar said, switching to Chinese now. "Do you understand?" "Yes," Joshua and I said in unison. In an instant, the bamboo stick was in his hand, and the other end was bouncing off of Joshua's head. I covered my own head with my arms, but the blow never came.
"Did I strike the Messiah?" Gaspar asked Joshua.
Joshua seemed genuinely perplexed. He paused, rubbing the spot on his head, when another blow caught him over his other ear, the sound of the impact sharp and harsh in the small stone room.
"Did I strike the Messiah?" Gaspar repeated.
Joshua's dark brown eyes showed neither pain nor fear, just confusion, as deep as the confusion of a calf who has just had its throat cut by the temple priest. The stick whistled through the air again, but this time I caught it in mid-swing, wrenched it out of Gaspar's hand, and tossed it out the narrow window behind him. I quickly folded my hands and looked at the table in front of me.
"Begging your pardon, master," I said, "but if you hit him again, I'll kill you."
Gaspar stood, but I was afraid to look at him, or Joshua for that matter.
"Ego," said the monk.
He left the room without another word. Joshua and I sat in silence for a few minutes, thinking and rubbing our goose eggs. Well, it had been an interesting trip and all, but Joshua wasn't very well going to learn much about being the Messiah from someone who hit him with a stick whenever it was mentioned, and that, I supposed, was the reason we were there. So, onward. I drank the bowl of tea in front of me, then the one that Gaspar had left. Two wise men down, one to go, I said. We'd better find some breakfast if we're going to travel.
Joshua looked at me as perplexed as he had at Gaspar a few minutes before. Do you think he needs that stick?